Well, thanks for joining us for another edition of On Point. I'm really pleased today. We've got a nice guest who I've known for a while from the whole building services industry, Mr. Netsa Jack. I mean, he's got a Master of Science in Renewables. He's a Bachelor of Engineering. He's doing his MBA at Warwick. And there's no better person to explain to us how we can save the planet and also keep the buildings functional and looking great. I know he's got a lot to say about sustainability and, you know, like the whole thermals and how we use efficiency within a building. Netsa, welcome.
Hi, guys. Hi, Rod. How are you doing?
Yeah,
pleasure to be part of this.
Excellent. No, I've been waiting a long time to get some of your time and just give us some insights, because I know a lot of people that have been listening and been feeding back saying that they really like to get behind, you know, people that are in the industry and working in the industry and how they see building services throughout. So where have you been? What have you been working on? Where are you currently? Maybe give the audience a little bit of backstory.
I've been living in the UK 22 years, been in the industry for just over 26 years. But I started as an electrician working in a brewery. My main desire at that point was just to get a degree within the, you know, sort of engineering capacity. Coming to the UK, the building services industry was very attractive to me because it gave me the opportunity to apply the skills that I already had. And doing the building services degree at London South Bank, you know, helped develop that, as well as, you know, working in the industry at the time. And that also gave me the opportunity. I think I'm quite fortunate to be able to say that I'm one of the few people who has come full circle within the industry, where I've worked on the service provider side, I've worked on the client side, which I currently am now, and I worked in consultancy, which is the longest job I've held since living in the UK. I worked for engineering consultancy called Hurley Palmer Flatt, who are now HDR. They were acquired by an American engineering firm about 2 years ago. So in doing that, working with the likes of large European developers and global developers such as British Land and Tishman Speyer, who are based out of New York, they gave me the opportunity to sort of use and develop the skills that I had from the degree, which led me to do an MSc in renewable energy and energy management, which is something I've always done even before, you know, doing that master's. And then I felt, you know, one of my previous bosses said I'm a glutton for abuse when it comes to education. But for me, I love learning. I enjoy learning. And the MBA is something I always looked at and wanted to do. And I felt in doing that, you know, people say an MBA is something that you do for yourself. But for me, I think, yes, in doing it for myself, but it gives me also the opportunity now to use some of those skills within the organization and sort of help push to get to that sort of next zone or that next level. I now work for the FA within the FM team as a senior technical services manager. Part of my role there is, you know, looking for new ways and innovation to get us not just to best practice within the industry, but sort of make a stamp or make somewhat of a change in the way we do things. And doing this MBA at Warwick Business School has definitely given me the ability to do that, especially over the last year, completing year one of the MBA. So that's sort of where I am right now and sort of where I've come from, which is somewhat of a journey, I must say.
it is a journey. You say you come from where originally? Where are you from?
Trinidad. Oh, sunny, yeah. Trinidad in the Caribbean.
Yeah, beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I mean, the FA, do you have any previous in sport? Have you ever been football?
Yeah, so a lot of people ask the question, how did you get into, you know, how did the opportunity come about? How did you get into work for the FA? And they just football focused. I was like, well, actually, no. So I do have previous sporting involvement. I used to play for Mill Hill County, which was a semi-pro team. I played for them for 6 years. Last played in 2013. So yeah, that was quite enjoyable, but that was not a prerequisite for me joining the FA, which, you know, they at least they would like have people who have some involvement in event management or sport. But I think my background was more than enough. Obviously, coming into an engineering capacity, I understood the sport very well. I understood the stadium very well. Wembley Stadium, or should I say New Wembley Stadium, was a construction project that I paid very close attention to. So I understand a lot about the stadium. That played to my advantage in getting the role. So yes, sport is something that has always been in my life, and that has been quite good for me going into working for the FA.
What I like to, especially with guests that have a real interest in what we do, is I use an acronym called POINT, which is really where the On Point podcast comes from. So the first part of that is P, and it's the potential. So where do you see is our greatest potential for change and improvement?
So there's a few things to consider here. So around 2008, around that period where we had that financial crisis, there was an EU directive that came into effect, which was around the whole environmental piece. It took everyone quite a while to really adapt to that. Obviously, Brexit coming in, we're no longer in the EU, but the UK government has still sort of created a somewhat of a framework with the net zero plan. And when you look back at that and you look as to where we are now with the whole ESG piece, which is the environmental, social and governance, you know, for compliance for organizations, you have to ask yourself, wow, we had the opportunity to really take this on board almost 15 years ago. And now we're all rushing to try and be compliant. And I think now you would see more of a sense of urgency with that. But to answer your question in terms of, you know, what where do we go now? I would say it would be one of three things. One, the hybrid model, which none of us really know or understand what it is or how it's going to work. But for now, let's just say the hybrid model is some form of flexibility where you are able to be productive, just as productive at home as you are in the office, but giving people in the workspace that autonomy to decide how that is going to work. The second bit is, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Edge building in Amsterdam. Have you ever heard of it?
I've heard of it, but I've not looked into the details.
So the Edge building is a building I visited in Amsterdam back in 2017. And that sort of environment is where I would see building stock going for the next short term 10 years. Because one, the technology, yes, it gives, you know, the building is integrated with you, the individual, and your smart device connected to different sort of systems within the building, be it your desk, be it in the restaurant where you eat, be it in the gym. It's very, very engaging, that sort of setup, a very green space, very fishbowl type building, but very user-friendly, not just for the day-to-day person who works there, but also visitors, people coming to visit the buildings. The other thing is, the third part, I believe, is which has to come in place for especially the service providers within the building services industry to remain relevant is the way in which they manage the assets. So we're familiar that SFG 20 has been the guideline or the framework that we have used within the industry to manage and maintain assets for landlords, for occupiers. I think that has to change now, especially with what I saw in the pandemic, where you have a range of buildings unoccupied, but you still have to maintain the space. How do you go about doing that Do you maintain that same regime? Do you, obviously that has to change because the level of resource obviously went down during that period of time with staff not being on site, maintenance staff being cut back, so you have a minimum sort of maintenance taking place. And the best approach in doing that right now with the technology we have is the use of analytics, where the analytics system provides an output for the status of, you know, what plant is operating, and the system actually tells you, right, this is a system that needs overhauling or maintaining now based on its operation or based on whatever, instead of using a, let's say, 100-page document that says, okay, that pump needs to be maintained every 3 months, or you need to do emergency light testing every year or whatever, where you now use the data, which is for me one of the most important commodities, or if not the most important commodity that we have in the world now, data. Using that data to, one, help us save on, you know, the resource we use, but also to help within the buildings to keep us on top of where we go and what we maintain, so, you know, we're not just following routine.
With that said, are there any opportunities, do you think, for cost saving by this sort of collaborative, integrative, using new technology for analytics? So not just it's good for the planet, but is the ultimate client going to be able to cost savings by implementing this type of stuff?
Certainly, and that leads to one of the other points I want to focus on here is the whole point of the analytics platform leads on to the question or the point that every building is different, every building should be treated differently. And with the use of these guides and frameworks that we've used in the past, you could tailor your design to, you know, to suit, obviously, the building that you're operating. But obviously, in this instance, you have the use of your data and your actual systems to help improve that. And I think one of the key things we're going to see, especially with building regulations and design going forward, to help us meet those net zero targets that have been set by the government and all the other various bodies, is each building going forward now will have to look at how can they be self-sufficient in terms of the energy that they use. And I think battery storage is just one of the new technologies, I would say, coming into play that we would definitely have to explore a lot more. The use of hydrogen, that is not something that is widely used in the UK just yet, but I would say that is another technology that once developed, you know, we would definitely need to explore the use of fuel cells. I'm aware that, you know, fuel cells is something that has been, you know, tried and integrated across several commercial buildings across the UK. I'm not sure of the success. But definitely, and look, when you look back at how we've moved on from technology such as CHP, the use of CHP, I remember some of the challenges I've had looking at CHP operations for the likes of Sky and the NHS Trust.
Yeah, what is CHP?
Oh, CHP. So that's combined heating and power. So
okay.
The use of CHP is... Your main, right, so the initial technology was the use of natural gas, mm-hmm, to produce heat and electricity. So it's similar to a generator. It's uses a turbine, uses also the gas chamber to which produces the heat from the turbine. The heat from the turbine is now turned into useful heat, where you could use for a district heating system or low temperature hot water system. Further developed, they're the likes of a CCHP system, so combined cooling, heating, and power. Sky in Australia at their headquarters, their energy center, uses this technology. Further on from that, instead of using natural gas, You could use the likes of biomass as your main fuel. You use biomass as your main fuel to replace natural gas. So,
are they using biomass in, you've got groundwater pumps and stuff like that, but in commercial buildings, are they using biomass?
So in commercial buildings, I know British Land did quite a bit of that. They have used biomass solely for low temperature hot water as the primary source of heating, natural gas being the sort of standby. Unfortunately, there wasn't a large take up of it in design within commercial buildings. I think mainly because of the transport issues. When you look at the carbon footprint of what it will take to transport the fuel, the biomass wood chip or wood pellets from out of London, that distance, a lot of landlords didn't see it as feasible. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a large uptake with the biomass use, but it is a very good form of, and you know, green form of using fuel for heating.
Yeah, I mean, I know over the years we've looked at solar, photovoltaics, the use of, solar shades, Bulbri Soleil. When people are talking about net zero, I mean, how realistic is net zero anyway? Or is it something we're just working towards in the hope that we're just a continuous improvement? Or is actually a reality that we can see?
My honest point is, net zero can be achieved, but we are way off from getting there even in the next 10 years. We would have to see a drastic change in our behaviors, in our design, in the way we operate. And I don't think just using offsetting, like for instance, putting wind turbines in Turkey or a solar farm in Saudi Arabia is going to help us achieve that. We will have to see a massive change in the way we live, in the way we design our systems, and in the way they operate. And I understand, the objective of the UK government and what they're trying to do, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. For instance, let's look at the EV market, the electric vehicle market, where one of the targets has been set that they want to eradicate the use of diesel and petrol. First of all, that has to stem from our desire for the fast car.
Let's not talk about we cannot eradicate fast cars.
Correct. So that technology has to improve in order to get the consumer to really say yes. Unless you're an individual like me who has made up my mind where my next vehicle is going to be an EV, an electric vehicle, whether it's fast or not,
Hold on, does that mean you're going to abandon watching F1 versus E1?
No. I'm still going to watch my F1. But one of the other things, as you mentioned there, with the whole net zero approach, the government mentioned that they want to also limit or stop the use of gas-fired boilers by 2025. It all comes down, setting all these objectives and goals are all well and good, but they need to be speaking to the right people in terms of how we go about this, what the design, and it comes back to the institutions like SIBSE and the IET. They need to be working closely, because in setting these goals, you need to be speaking to the experts who operate these buildings, who set the design guidelines to ensure that we're on the right track, or we have the capability and the capacity to implement these things in such a short space of time. 10 years is not a long time. 10 years is a very short period in the building services industry. A lot of our life cycle costing plans are 4 to 8 years, so within two cycles, we're already there within, you know, that 10-year plan. So there needs to be some real robust guidelines and plans put in place.
With the challenges or the targets that they've set, 2050 and getting rid of cars and getting rid of diesel and everything going electric. I mean, if we don't do that, what do you see as the biggest impact that's going to be to, well, society and the building services industry?
The UN published a report stating if we don't change the way we live, and we're not talking building services here, we're talking in general. Building services would just be, and building operation would just be one aspect. But yeah, that report clearly stated that what is going to happen to sort of our climate, our lifestyles. We're seeing the fires as taking place around, you know, a couple of years ago, we had Australia with the fires. We now have Greece. We're seeing the flooding. We're seeing the very weird seasonal changes. In April, we had some of the worst frost, you know, that we've seen for years, you know. It's not something we sort of expect in April. April is usually the period where, you know, we see a lot of rain, and it was very, very different. So
if you were king for the year and you're going to do your bit, the final point is the transformation point. Where do you think, and what do you think we should be doing? What would your edict be for a sort of a global transformation to actually hit this 10-year target in the sort of bullet points, or if you've got a more interesting view of what we should be doing? And saving some money, of course.
Yeah, for me, the starting point is education. There are a lot of people who, you know, they have different point of views of what the net zero is and the whole energy and sustainability piece. And it seems to be like a lot of noise. It's ensuring that, you know, we send the right messages and we educate, get rid of the misinformation. You know, we live in a world of fake news now, and is ensuring that, you know, we have the right people giving the right message. I'm not sure what the primary and secondary schools curriculums are in line with these things, but I guess that's a starter. The second sort of point is, you know, I know some organizations do it, but educating your staff, you know, embedding that culture, changing the culture, that's where the start is. It's ensuring that, you know, giving them the understanding of the impact it's going to have, and also bringing them on board, you know, giving them the opportunity to share their views of where they think, you know, we're going, and what, you know, what could change, what we could change. It doesn't always have to come from the top.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting, I mean, education throughout these podcasts, there seems to be, from industry professionals like yourself, there is always, we need to educate more. We need to educate within our ranks, educate new people coming into the industry, and almost like, we, you know, even if you've been in it 30, 40 years, you can still be an apprentice and still be learning. I mean, you know, I think I understand energy and sustainability and net zero and carbon footprint. However, there's probably just small changes that we can all do. For instance, we're looking at electric vans, you know, rather than diesel vans. And, you know, when you think how many vans are out in the field, when you think how many businesses, if everyone sort of like just made a little improvement, it amounts to a lot. Obviously, with the advent of emails, you know, we've cut down the amount of paper. So there are computer benefits that have already been improved. But I think when I think of some of these, and a building that just sort of springs to mind when I say it, it's like the Lloyd's building. And it just, like an iconic building, but it just looks like it's, there's lots going on. You know, it's industrial, and it's just like, you can imagine all the power and the generators and the turbines and, you know, the air cooling systems that are going on. to you know, and you mentioned it early on. Does it start at design?
That point you raise is probably one of the most valid points you've raised there in terms of the architect. You know, it tends to start with the concept, the architect's concept. That has always been the biggest challenge in the building services sort of field, where how do you integrate systems? And now, with, you know, the how we live, how do you integrate systems that can make this building work, but also ensure that it's efficient and the energy intensity is as minimal as possible? And using that Lloyd's building, for example, I am sure they're faced with, you know, probably the greatest challenge now in terms of, you know, how do we curtail, you know, our operation to make this building energy efficient? And let's take another example, as you raise that Lloyd's, another iconic building that I remember reading a case study for, the Chrysler building in New York. That landlord at the time, Tishman Speyer, they are very innovative in terms of, you know, in terms of construction and building services. Early on, you know, they were on board with making their buildings energy efficient, which led to, you know, making the buildings more attractive for the clients that they and customers that they want to attract to occupy these buildings. And because of the design, they really had to, and this was, I'm talking like 12 years ago, they really had to think outside the box because, you know, as you know, in New York, their heating system, they use these furnaces and steam to heat their buildings. You know, the lighting was, you know, that old tungsten type lighting. Yeah. The chillers were over 50 years old. You know, so they really had to think, right, this building is one of the most iconic buildings in the world. How do we continue to, yes, keep this building relevant, but also try and reduce that, you know, energy intensity of the building and operation and still, you know, keep this building as one of the most iconic buildings in the world. And as I said before, with the whole net zero piece, that is one of the things that is going to be our biggest challenge, that design, but also maintaining that iconic building stock. You know, how do we now look at the opportunities to maintain these buildings and show, you know, we keep these buildings up and reduce their energy intensity. And that also goes back to what I was mentioning, being self-sufficient. How could we explore making these buildings more self-sufficient with on-site generation?
Well, Netzer, it's an interesting discussion, and it's going to be one that rolls on for the next 10 years. And I hope, well, I know that you're certainly going to be part of it. I hope to, you know, keep learning and maybe be able to implement some small changes. But for now, you know, I'd just like to thank you for joining me. And, you know, look, we could talk for another 10 podcasts, and I think it would be, you know, we should revisit some of the topics and maybe drill down to them another date. But just like to say thank you for your time. I hope the audience, you've got some real insight and some value from this conversation. Netzer, anything you'd like to end on?
Yeah, just like to say, yeah, this has been a very insightful discussion. You know, it gives us the opportunity to really reflect and talk about, you know, some of the underlying issues we have in the industry and what we need to do going forward to, you know, to help us to ensure that, you know, we get to that sort of target that we're trying to achieve, and in light of that, ensure that we, you know, protect this environment and this ecosystem that we live in. And as I continue to tell people, as you've mentioned, every day I'm continuously learning, and that is the key for us all. You know, we don't know everything, and you know, every day we're being thrown these new challenges. So to help address that, we have to continue with an open mind and continue learning and sharing that knowledge that we already have, because that's the only way we're going to get over this hurdle.
Excellent. Thank you again. I hope you can join us again sometime. For you listening, if you like what you're hearing, subscribe to the podcast and see you on the next episode. Thanks again. Bye for now.